Hills is now in session. The Honorable Craig H. Nakamura, Daniel R. Foley, and Catherine G. Leonard presiding. Please be seated. Case number 29703, State of Hawaii v. Chester Pequeen. Brian R. Vincent for appellant, Craig W. Jerome for appellee. Argument on the merits.
Counsel, ready to proceed?
Good morning. May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Brian Vincent on behalf of the State of Hawaii. In my opening brief, I discussed the factors set out in State v. Park, and I tried to address all the factors that the circuit court relied on in this case. And our State's position is that none of the factors support a finding of de minimis in this case. What I would like to take my time here in oral argument is to discuss the statutes involved here. I'm going to start with the unsworn falsification to authority statute, because that's what the circuit court wanted us to charge this case as. The unsworn falsification of the authority statute was enacted in 1972 as part of the recodification of criminal law based on the Model Penal Code. The commentary indicates that it was an attempt to divide falsification to authorities into four different categories based on aggravating circumstances and culpability. Section 710.1063, the unsworn falsification statute, is basically a catch-all category for all those falsifications made to authorities that are not made under oath. Okay. The unsworn falsification statute or offense contains three elements: submitting or inviting reliance on a writing, which the person knows to be falsely made, completed, or altered, and which is intended to mislead a public servant in the performance of their duties. Clearly, defendant could have been charged with unsworn falsification to authorities in this case because all the elements are met. The UPCPI statute is a more recent enactment, and it grew out of the Hawaii Anti-Phishing Task Force's 2006 report on electronic commerce-based crime. The task force was concerned by the fact that law enforcement often would catch suspects with personal information of people, but they hadn't done anything with it yet. Okay, so they wanted to make that mere possession a more serious offense. Usually it involved credit cards and so forth, but it could be anything. It could be a piece of paper with a credit card number on it. They were only able to charge as a petty misdemeanor because I think it was only, I think they were usually charging as a fourth degree theft offense instead of a...
Excuse me, counsel. Mm-hmm. You said personal information, but doesn't the statute require the personal information to be confidential?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
I mean, isn't that really the key issue in this case, whether the information involved was confidential or not?
Well, whether or not the conduct met the elements of the offense was the subject for the motion to dismiss for lack of sufficient evidence. And that's not at issue today because that's not an appealable order by the defendant at this point. It's got to be appealed after the conviction. And
do we have to agree with the circuit court's analysis on that issue?
Not necessarily, but I would think that it would be better to wait until trial, until all the facts came out.
But it seems in terms of the de minimis analysis, we sort of have to analyze to what extent the conduct in this case fell within the parameters of the statute. If we find that the statute doesn't cover the conduct, isn't that a good reason to uphold the de minimis finding?
If this court chooses to do that, I guess that's what will happen. So.
So what's your argument as to why? Well, first of all, the one question I had is the record was supplemented with the preliminary hearing transcript.
Yeah,
and I referred to the fact that the citation included the neighbor's driver's license information.
That's
the
correct.
The statute is clearly confidential personal information.
So that's
the
correct.
Items identified.
That's correct.
All right, but that information was not, as I understand it, presented to the circuit court judge who issued the ruling on the de minimis.
It was not submitted into evidence. That's correct, and
right.
We apologize for that.
Is that something that on appeal we can consider in evaluating whether the circuit court was erroneous or not in its decision?
My first argument is that according to State v. Otterson, the burden of it is on the defendant in the motion to dismiss for de minimis grounds. The burden of proof is on the defendant. That the defendant must establish that his or her conduct neither caused nor threatened to cause the harm. My position is that I think that it should have been presented by the defendant at the hearing on the de minimis motion. It's clearly because they bear the burden to inform the court of all the pertinent facts in this situation. The deputy prosecuting attorney did not do it either. So that would have been nice if he would have, but that's I think it's the burden shouldn't be on the prosecuting attorney at that stage to present all the facts. He could have, and he should have probably. But
so your analysis is because it's the defendant's burden that we can consider.
Yes.
Even though he was not presented to the trial judge.
Yeah, and also another question is that basically by overruling by granting the motion for de minimis, if the court based it on whether there was insufficient evidence, it would have to be in effect overturning the finding of the district court and finding that there was probable cause to take this case to trial.
Effectively is because the trial court denied the motion to dismiss for insufficiency, that's law of the case, and so we should start with that presumption in looking at the de minimis infraction.
Well, I would submit that's true. Mm-hmm. Okay. Be that as it may, the state's position is that name, address, and date of birth, as it was used in this case, is confidential and personal information because it clearly was used in a way to assume the victim's identity in this case. It's very clear that he intended to assume the victim's identity in this case. I agree that you probably can find somebody's date of birth if you do some sort of search. You know, it's not as a closely guarded secret as many things are, but the way it was used in this case was to evade the ticket in this case.
So your position is even if we don't consider the driver's license number, name, identity, name, address, date of birth, in the way it was used, satisfies the definition of confidential personal information.
That's my position. My secondary position is that even if you don't consider the preliminary hearing transcripts, the testimony in the findings of fact made by the court in both of these cases, in the case that the officer wrote out a citation for in this case, okay, and the district court has been delegated the authority to draw up the citation forms, and the citation forms all contain blanks for driver's license number and the last four digits of the social security number. Okay, I think there's a strong inference that there was a Hawaii's driver's license written down in the citation that was given to the defendant in this case.
Now, one of the things that the de minimis statute requires the court to look at is whether the conduct in the case caused or threatened the harm designed to be protected by the offense, or did so in a non-trivial manner. Now, as I look at the identity theft provisions, they're focused on using someone's identity for monetary gain. You know, it incorporates theft second, theft third. In this case, there's no monetary gain. So why is the conduct in this case aimed at or involved with the purpose of the identity theft statutes if no monetary gain is involved?
Well, he did it to avoid incurring a liability, and that is an item of benefit to him. If he had not have assumed his neighbor's identity, he would have had to pay $100, $200 in tickets probably.
Is there anything in legislative history that suggests that the legislature intended the identity theft provisions to cover this type of conduct?
There's nothing that I could find that was directly presented to the Hawaii legislature on this case. Our office, I would note that our office did testify that a specific problem with this possession of identity theft was non-monetary harms. Okay, our office submitted testimony that according to a 2004 survey, average total number of hours to repair damage caused by identity theft was 330 hours, and secondary effects such as inability to obtain credit, higher credit, and insurance rates could continue for many years afterwards, 4 to 5 years afterwards. Okay, this is the same sort of thing, because except for the fortuitous circumstance here that the officer forgot to give one of the tickets to the defendant, defendant would have had two citations. Who knows how long the defendant would have kept on doing this, okay? And once you get all these citations on your record, it takes time and effort to clear your driver's license record again. And I think that's exactly the kind of harm that the legislature wanted.
Counsel, when you talked about why the legislature enacted this Unauthorized Possession of Confidential Personal Information Act, you said it was to cover something that wasn't really covered in prior legislation, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But wasn't lying to a police officer already covered by a different statute prior to the enactment of this statute?
Well, lying to the police officer is. And if this was a case where defendant had said, you know, my name is Mortimer Schnurd and my birthday is, you know, something, 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 okay, that would be lying to an officer. But in this particular case, the defendant gave a real person's address, identifying information to the officer.
That was just to prevent being charged, the same, I mean.
To prevent being charged and to prevent having an arrest warrant served on him.
Right.
Yeah, so.
Do we know what the warrants were for? In the record?
Well, the record here, in the record on the motion, one of the records is a violation.
Do we know from the records what I'm asking?
Yeah, in one of the transcripts that was made part of the record, it was we made a motion to revoke his probation, and I believe it was a felony offense. I'm not sure if these warrants were related to the felony offense, but so I guess.
The answer is no.
It's no, but I don't know absolutely for sure. But okay, he's wanted for other things. Okay, so
now, counsel, we're to give some deference, right, to the lower court?
That's correct, and we understand that this statute has legislatively taken away some discretion that the state has in charging. Okay. Normally, we would be able to charge anything that fit the elements of the offense, but you're right, we're giving the circuit court some deference here.
So regardless of which way the court ruled, whether it granted or denied the motion, we have to give it some deference, right?
That's great. But
So to tell us where the lower court went wrong, where did the lower court abuse its discretion in making either factual findings or making the ultimate determination that this was a de minimis violation?
Our position is that none of the facts in this case are mitigating facts. And I went through each of the factors, and I explained why I thought that they were not mitigating facts. So that's what we think is an abuse of discretion in this case. It was, I can go through some of the particular factors here. I can go through each of the factors here if you want to ask me more questions about those. Not the proper charge, okay? We believe that this is the proper charge because there's a victim in this case.
There would be a charge, though, that may more closely fit, though, the allegations, right?
Well, we think that this charge more closely fits the allegation because there's a victim in this case. And it's not just somebody lies to a police officer, says that somebody did this to me when they actually didn't, okay?
So we're not just talking about trying to get an enhanced sentence.
We believe this is a serious conduct. I did reference the GOA report that was made to the federal government 2002, I believe, and they specifically noted that one of the harms that was caused by identity theft was criminal investigation, arrest, or conviction. And they noted their study of the 94,000 identity theft complaints reported to the Federal Trade Commission in a period in 2000, about 1,300 involved that category of harm. They took some examples from their study. They took 10 random examples, apparently, and two of those involved legal consequences.
Counsel, on a scale of 1 to 10, in terms of the seriousness of identity theft, where would you put this?
I would put this on, 7 or 8.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm
right up there with credit cards. And
I mean, if I call up my credit card company and when I ask them the credit information, the first thing they ask me is, what's your date of birth? There's no indication in the record whatsoever that this defendant would not have used that.
In terms of harm to the victim, in a scale of 1 to 10, you put it right up there with credit card?
I don't, in terms of the harm that happened in this actual case, I wouldn't put it so high, but I would put it in the terms of the threat of harm that was posed by this case. I would put it 7 or 8.
So you're saying in this case, actually, the victim was lucky that the police officer actually believed him when he showed him the ticket and said, hey, "It's not my car."
That's right. Mm-hmm. And we're all involved, and we're about judges, prosecutors, everybody. We deal with criminal defendants every day, and we're skeptical sometimes of the stories they tell us. The police officer obviously in this case remembered giving the citation in this case apparently and cleared the matter up within apparently the victim didn't wasn't down at the police station for longer than hopefully not more than an hour. Okay.
So on a scale of 1 to 10. Potential harm was way up there, but the actual harm, because of what happened, was a bit lower.
Exactly. The actual harm, what happened in this case, is lower. Okay. None of us would like to interrupt our day to have to go down to the police station to clear up a ticket that's not ours, okay? So there's clearly some harm here, actual harm.
So the initial citations were for what?
One was fraudulent safety check. That was the criminal one, and I think the other one was an expired registration, I think.
So he should have had to show up for both those offenses.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And the second citation was he was stopped for what in the second time?
I don't remember because they never actually issued the citation, and then in the second case they caught him. They recognized him apparently from the first time, and the fact that the victim had complained at the police station, When he presented the citation, they said, "Oh yeah, you're the same guy that happened. It was here 2 weeks ago."
So it was fraudulent safety check.
That's right.
Citation.
Yeah.
That's criminal.
Yeah, that's right.
And the other one was because one of the non-criminal one was the one that was put in his mailbox. Right?
I think the reason why they pulled him over, the probable reasonable suspicion they ever pulled him over was the
expired registration, and then they found out when they ran a check on the safety check that it was fraudulent. It wasn't his. It didn't match the plates, I think. I'm not sure if that's part of the record, but I suspect that's what happened. But my argument basically is that if the legislature had been faced with this particular type of a factual situation, I think they would have regarded this as a relatively egregious example of the type of conduct that they wanted to penalize under the possession of confidential personal information statute. Yeah. I'll rest on that.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Deputy Public Defender Craig Jerome, appearing on behalf of the defendant appellee, Chester Paquin. In this case, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing the de minimis charge against Mr. Paquin for two reasons. The first reason is because Mr. Paquin's conduct did not fit within the conduct prescribed by HRS Section 708-839.55, which is the unauthorized possession of confidential personal information statute. The second reason is, even assuming that Mr. Paquin's conduct does fit
counsel,
within...
excuse me, but the state is arguing here that we need to consider the context of the information in determining whether or not it's confidential. And therefore, in the context of this case, possession of name, address, and birth date is sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the first issue under whether or not his conduct fit within the statute, is whether or not the information was, in fact, confidential personal information as defined in 708-800. And I think we run into problems when we start to say this type of information is confidential personal information if it's used in this manner, but it's not confidential personal information if it's used in a different manner. I think...
Isn't that what the statute says, though? Other name, number, or code that is used alone or in conjunction with other information to confirm the identity of a person? So, I mean, doesn't the definition itself require us to do the contextual inquiry?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't believe so. I think that, and the definition is not a model of clarity, but I think looking at the plain language of the definition, confidential personal information means information in which an individual has a significant privacy interest. So any information in which an individual has a significant privacy interest is confidential personal information. And I believe from that point on, the definition is simply examples of that type of information.
Right, but if it falls within the example given, doesn't that by definition mean it the legislature felt that it was an item that had significant privacy interest?
Well, I believe that, or any other name, number, or code that is used alone or in conjunction to confirm the identity of a person is an example, but that name, number, or code still has to be information in which the individual has a significant privacy interest. I don't think that overrides the beginning part of the definition. And if you look at the definition of personal information, the last example that's given in personal information is the exact same thing. It's any other name, number, or code that is used in alone or in conjunction.
Right, but that, reading those two provisions together, that would lead me to conclude that the last clause is confidential personal information, because personal information is a broad category. Certain things that are listed in personal information are not listed in confidential personal information, but that last clause is listed in both. So that suggests to me that the legislature felt that that was a category that was properly defined as confidential personal information.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I think that if the court reads the definitions in that manner, what you're basically would be doing would be eliminating any difference between the definition of personal information and confidential personal information. And in that case, I mean, if personal information is any other name, any information that's used to confirm the identity of a person, and confidential personal information is the same thing, then there's no distinction between the two, and there was no reason to create this separate definition for confidential personal information.
No, because personal information, for example, includes mail address. The confidential personal information doesn't. So if you just had the mail address by itself, that wouldn't constitute confidential personal information under the statute. But the statute seems to say, but if you use different items that ordinarily would not be confidential personal information in conjunction to confirm a person's identity, then it becomes. Isn't that the way to read the statute? I'm not clear as to what is that last clause directed at if it's not directed at the situation?
I believe that other clause is directed at sort of giving a catch-all provision where the legislature says we can't include every example of what confidential personal information is, maybe because there may be new forms of confidential personal information that arise in the future, or because we just can't have a list that's 150 or 200 examples long. But I believe that a reading of the plain language of the definition would say that it still has to be information in which an individual has a significant privacy interest. I believe those are just examples, because it says including but not limited to.
I take it if there was legislative history, you would cite it as to that. Is there any legislative history that talks about what they meant by that last clause?
I wasn't able to find any legislative history that specifically talks about the definition. I mean, I think that most of the legislative history in this case comes from the Hawaii Anti-Phishing Task Force report and the legislature's actual comments on the changes they made to the definitions or the offenses are not really that carefully explained.
All right, but there's no dispute that if we consider the driver's license number, that's clearly confidential personal information under the statute.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, so address for me the question of whether or not we can consider the preliminary hearing testimony, which clearly states both by the victim and the police officer that the citation that the defendant displayed the second stop contained the neighbor's driver's license number and the last four digits of his Social Security number.
Okay, Your Honor. And I believe this court cannot consider the preliminary hearing transcript properly. The preliminary hearing transcript is not relevant to the disposition of the motion that was before the trial judge, because the trial judge did not consider that preliminary hearing transcript at the time of the motion. It was not introduced into evidence.
But is it part of the totality of the circumstances of your client's conduct?
I don't believe so, because to do that would be incredibly unfair to the trial judge in this case, to say we're going to overturn your decision based on information that was not available to you at the time that you made that decision. To me, that would be akin to an appeal where the question is whether there was insufficient evidence to convict a client or to convict a defendant in a trial, and then the state on appeal says, well, we may not have introduced sufficient evidence at the trial, but there's all this evidence that was introduced at the prelim that we didn't include, so we want the court to consider that. The defense had no opportunity in this case to cross-examine the witnesses in that hearing specifically on the issues in this case. The trial court didn't make any findings as to the credibility of those witnesses. It's an entirely different burden of proof in a preliminary hearing. It's just whether there's probable cause to believe that the defendant has committed the offense. Neither attorney that was presented the motion was present at the preliminary hearing. And this idea that we should have somehow on our own introduced a preliminary hearing transcript, I think is totally incorrect. This is not a case where we sort of controlled the evidence that was introduced at the hearing on the motion. What happened was we stipulated in both parties' versions of the facts. It was kind of done after the fact, but you know, we didn't contest any of the evidence that the state presented at the hearing on the motion. It was sort of taken as a whole from their memorandum in opposition to the motion. So,
this must have worked though. It's your motion, right?
It was our motion.
It's a motion to dismiss. So don't you have at least the initial burden of putting on the factual record to provide the court with the relevant background so you can make an informed decision?
We do have the burden of proof in the motion, but if the state disagreed with anything that was in our counsel's declaration, it had every opportunity to introduce stuff.
It's not a disagreement, it's an omission, right? I mean, it's not a situation where someone said X and you disagree with X. It was a situation in which some factor involving the case was not presented.
Well, it's an omission, but there's nothing in the record to indicate that the deputy public defender who handled the motion was aware of this information or purposely omitted it. I mean, if I'm the state and I'm opposing this motion and I know that one of the big issues, and this was not just a motion to dismiss for de minimis, this was a motion to dismiss for insufficient evidence. And I read the other counsel's declaration and I take the time to draft my own version of the facts, I'm going to make sure that every relevant fact is in there. I mean, the state had the opportunity to question the witnesses prior to this hearing. The state had the opportunity to present testimony at this hearing if they had wished. I mean, this is, you know, and I could see maybe the state making that argument if this was a thing where only our declaration was entered into evidence or the state didn't draft the declaration, but I mean, this is what the state presented at the hearing. This is what the state argued at the hearing. The first time the issue of the driver's license number was presented in the context of this motion was in the state's opening brief. I mean, I know that our appellate division was totally unaware that this was an issue until we received the opening brief.
Are you saying that we should not consider the preliminary hearing transcript, or we cannot?
I believe that it would be improper for this court to consider that hearing.
So we cannot?
That would be my reading of the rules of appellate procedure is that you cannot.
What rule are you citing to? It's in the record, right?
It's in the record, but the record, if you look at Rule 10A, I believe is what's the contents of the record. It's in the record, but it's not a transcript that, and we actually did file a motion to strike it from the record, a motion to reconsider this court's order making it a part of the record based on these reasons, but it is in the record, but it's not a transcript that's relevant to the disposition of this motion. As I said, it's akin to introducing the preliminary hearing transcript to try to plug holes that were created during the trial.
Now, if we do consider the driver's license number, does that change your analysis in terms of the de minimis? In other words, if we do consider that, are you saying that your argument that the statute no longer applies obviously goes away, but does that mean it's not de minimis?
Well, our argument that the statute no longer applies actually doesn't go away at that point. There are two other reasons why we believe the statute doesn't apply. The second is because we don't believe that the defendant possessed the information within the meaning of the statute. And the third is that there was no evidence introduced during the hearing on the motions that were filed in this case.
Counsel, didn't the lower court find the statute did apply?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're asking us to affirm the lower court, but you've been spending all your time arguing why the lower court was wrong.
With regard to the motion for insufficient evidence, that's correct, Your Honor.
And that's not before us, right?
Well, it's not before you except for well established that this trial court can affirm the judgment of the lower court. This appellate court can affirm the judgment of the lower court on any grounds that supports affirmance. So
you feel the grounds on the de minimis are not very strong, and that's why you're arguing the other?
No, we believe that both are strong, actually.
And maybe you should argue one of them, the other one, too.
Yes, and even if that's the other thing, is even if this court does consider the fact that the defendant possessed the driver's license information, we believe that the trial court still did not abuse its discretion in granting the motion to dismiss for de minimis because it applied the totality of the circumstances test that's enunciated in State v. Park, and it did not exceed the bounds of reason or disregard rules or principles of law or practice in applying those factors.
Let me mention this. Assuming that we go with the lower court's decision that there was sufficient evidence, so the conduct is covered by the statute. I'm looking at the de minimis statute itself. So it says, looking at the nature of the conduct alleged and the nature of the attendant circumstances, the first finding the court has to make was the defendant's conduct within the customary license or tolerance which was not expressly refused by the person whose interest was infringed. I read from that is, did the victim authorize or consent to the conduct in this case? And the answer to that is, I assume, no.
Well, that's the other issue, is that the conduct in this case is not the use of the personal information. The conduct in this case is the possession of the personal information. That's the conduct with which Mr. Paquin was charged.
All right, but the victim didn't authorize the defendant to possess that information either.
Well, and if you look at the state's declaration in this case, the thing that it says in the state's declaration is that the complainant related to the police officers that he did not give the defendant permission to use his personal information. Not that he did not give the defendant permission to possess his personal information.
All right, but the purpose of the possession prohibition is because the legislature said, well, sometimes the police aren't able to catch the defendant actually using the confidential information, so we're going to make it a crime to possess it. So in that context, isn't possession and use related to each other?
They're related to one another in this particular case, I believe, but as a matter of statutory construction, I don't believe that they are. And I looked at every statute in all 50 states that pertain to this sort of information, and in every other state that penalizes possession of personal information, the defendant has to possess that information with some sort of malicious intent. Ours is the only state that penalizes just the possession of that information, even if you have no malicious intent, even if you never intend
wasn't
to use
there,
it.
Given that, if you look at it, the conduct in this case, didn't the defendant use the information with malicious intent?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why does that make a difference in the de minimis statute? Because for the de minimis infraction analysis, we have to look at the conduct and the attendant circumstances of that conduct.
That's correct, Your Honor, except for the trial court did not base its dismissal on Section 1A of the de minimis statute. It based it on Sections 1B and 1C of the de minimis statute.
All right, so B is, did not actually cause or threaten the harm or evil sought to be prevented by the law defining the offense. So what's your argument on that? Isn't the law prohibiting someone from using someone else's identity for monetary gain, isn't that implicated in this case in the sense that the defendant used his neighbor's identity to avoid being cited and having to pay the fine to avoid his monetary loss and imposing a potential monetary loss and criminal infringement upon his neighbor?
That's a possible reading of the statute. What the legislative history says is that the legislature intended to use this to prevent people from committing identity theft. And the identity theft statutes in this state are, if you use somebody else's identity to commit an A felony, or if you use somebody else's identity to commit some form of theft. And the defendant did not do that in this case. He did not commit some form of theft that's enumerated within the identity theft statutes. He committed this misdemeanor offense of unsworn falsification to law enforcement authorities. So what we have in this case is...
Isn't this kind of the classic evil that's intended to be prevented by identity theft statutes? In other words, is to prevent me from having to defend against something that I didn't do? Or to sustain a loss for some conduct that I didn't engage in, like a credit card or a check? Isn't this at least analogous? In other words, here you have an innocent neighbor who now has got the citation, which requires him, at least on the face of it, to show up in court to defend against a crime that he never committed, or a traffic citation that he wasn't involved in. Isn't this within the core of what the purpose of the identity theft statutes are designed to protect against?
Well, if that's the purpose of the identity theft statutes in this state, they don't do a very good job of it, because they don't penalize taking somebody else's identity for any of these purposes that are not to commit an A felony or to commit some form of theft.
Mr. Jerome, didn't the trial judge really rely more on the second clause of 1B, or did so only to the extent too trivial to warrant the condemnation of conviction of a felony?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that that's sort of the gist of the trial court's finding, is not that it didn't cause or threaten the harm, but that it did so to an extent that was too trivial. And the court's reasoning for that was that this, the complainant in this case did not actually suffer any of these consequences. The police immediately believed him when he told them that he didn't own this type of car, that he wasn't driving it on this night.
But does the statute require cause or threaten to cause? So don't we have to look at not only what actually happened, but what the harm that was threatened in the case?
And that's true, and it's difficult to know specifically what the threat, what the potential threat, what the actuality of the threat was in this case. You can sort of go through a litany of things that potentially could happen to somebody in this incident. But, you know, what the actual threatened behavior is much more difficult to ascertain than what the threatened behavior was is much more difficult to ascertain than what the actual harm was. And in this case, the actual harm to the complainant was
very minimal.
Wouldn't the
threatened behavior be that he shows up in court and no one believes him, so he gets cited for the violation or has to pay the violation?
I mean, I guess that's one of the possibilities. Another possibility is that he could show up in court and the police officer would be there to testify and you would say that's not the person I cited on this date. I mean, there's a whole the sort of potential of what could have happened in this case is sort of unknowable. It's, what we know is what the actual harm was. And under the Park factors, the resulting harm or evil, if any, caused or threatened by the infraction is just one of several factors that the court has to consider.
One of the questions I had in interpreting this de minimis statute is it purely, do we measure the conduct purely in relation to the charged offense, or do we look at, in some level, was the defendant's conduct significant enough so that prosecution is merited? In other words, in this case, we're all agreeing that he at least, the alleged conduct would satisfy a full misdemeanor violation for false information to authorities. And we also, I guess in the record, the indication that his reasons for doing so was not only to avoid other misdemeanors. He didn't have a license, he didn't have insurance, and and he had outstanding bench warrants. And that's were the reasons why he was motivated to provide this false information to the police officer. Now, if you look at his conduct, it seems to me we wouldn't want to characterize his conduct as de minimis. So how is that factored into this de minimis infraction analysis, if at all?
And I don't think anyone's arguing that Mr. Paquin's conduct in this case was admirable or was the right thing to do or shouldn't be punished in some manner. And I think it's an interesting question whether we need to consider his conduct just with regard to the offense that's charged or his conduct in general. And I think that goes into the sort of the circumstances concerning the offense. I think this court can consider the other sort of surrounding circumstances. The thing is, if you look at the actual use of the information in this case, the legislature has determined that the actual use of the information in this case is a misdemeanor violation, punishable up to a year in jail and a $2,000 fine. So to sort of convert the actual use into a felony based on the fact that he happened to know his neighbor's name, address, and date of birth is, I think, one of the things that concerned the trial court, and that's the trial court's findings that, you know, the conduct in this case doesn't warrant the possibility of a felony conviction. The court expressed that it was concerned that the defendant had been overcharged and that his conduct had been sort of pigeonholed and sort of crammed into this felony statute rather than being charged under what the court believed was the proper statute.
Right, but does the trial court have that role? In other words, isn't it the prosecutor who decides what the appropriate charge is?
Well, under the de minimis statute, I believe the trial court does have that role. The trial court, by applying the Park factors, can decide that looking at the totality of the circumstances, the sort of the punishment does not fit the crime in this case. And the commentary to the de minimis statute says specifically that You know, there's been concerns raised that different judges are going to apply the factors in different ways, and the commentary specifically says that the solution to that is not to require the permission of the prosecutor to dismiss these charges, because the prosecutor has already exercised his discretion in deciding what charges to bring. And of course the prosecutor is going to feel differently than the trial court, and different prosecutors are going to look at different conduct and come to different conclusions, just like different trial courts are going to come to different conclusions based on the totality of the circumstances by applying the Park factors.
Now, the cases that I'm familiar with that have actually dismissed on this statute are the only ones I can recall off the top of my head are for cases in which it's a drug possession violation and the amount of the drugs that is recovered is too small to have produced any kind of physiological effect. Are you aware of the other context in which an appellate court has affirmed the application of the de minimis statute to dismiss a charge?
The one that comes to the top of my mind is, and this is not a case, I actually looked at the cases where the appellate court had overturned a trial court's decision on the de minimis motion, whether the trial court had granted the dismissal or denied the dismissal. The one that I can think of is State v. Aquino, which is the custodial interference charge, where actually the trial court denied the motion to dismiss for de minimis, and the Supreme Court, I believe, overruled the judge's decision in that and said that this is clearly a case where this was
de minimis.
The cases were, I found four cases in my research where the appellate courts had overturned the trial courts. That's one of them, State v. Aquino. The other is State v. Park, which is where a trial court sort of en masse dismissed charges against 20 defendants and didn't make any sort of findings as to the facts and circumstances concerning each of the defendants and gave us this Park test. State v. Otterson, which is where Judge Towne, actually, who's the judge in this case, denied a motion to dismiss in a drug case. A different judge heard the trial and reconsidered the motion after the trial, and the Supreme Court held that there were no changes in facts or law that would allow a different judge to overturn the first judge's case. And the final one is State v. Schofield, where there were other issues, but the appellate court basically said, as sort of an aside, that trafficking in narcotics can never be a de minimis offense. And I don't know if that's ever been challenged, but that's my recollection. But, you know, I think that the state bears the burden of proving that the trial court abuses discretion in this case. Strong showing is required to demonstrate that. I've never located a case where a trial court goes through the Park factors, does so in a reasonable, defensible manner, doesn't misapply the law, doesn't find facts incorrectly, and the appellate courts in a published opinion have said, no, that's correct. This is not a case where we can substitute the prosecution's analysis of these factors. We can't substitute this court's analysis of these factors. This is not a case where the trial court abused its discretion. I think the closest analogy to this case is State v. Hinton, which is not a de minimis case. It's a Moriwaki case where the Hawaii Supreme Court said, look, if the trial court has discretion to make a decision and there's a set of factors and the trial court goes through those factors and applies them correctly, then the role of the appellate court is to affirm that decision because it's not an abuse of discretion. So we would say that we still maintain that the conduct in this case did not violate the UPCPI statute, and even if the conduct did violate the UPCPI statute, the trial court did not abuse its discretion because it went through the totality of the circumstances test that's dictated by Park, and it did not clearly exceed the bounds of reason or disregard rules or principles of law or practice. So we would ask this court to affirm the trial court's decision granting the defendant's motion to dismiss for de minimis and affirm the court's order. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would just like to reiterate that the defendant's scheme in this case would not have worked if he had not used the information of a real person. And that's the one element that's included in the UPCPI statute, which is not included in the unsworn falsification authority statute. So We believe that we chose the right charge. And we would ask this court to reverse the order dismissing for de minimis, remand it for a retrial. And if the judge feels at sentencing that this is there are mitigating circumstances, this would be a factor for sentencing rather than for a de minimis hearing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Take the case under advisement.
All rise. Court is now in recess.